As Gaza residents built a tent city near the wall as part of a planned six-week-long protest kicking off today, which is known as Land Day. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berger, Nate Feldstein, Augusta Nermin Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 4:59 and 41 seconds. Coming up next is your Friday evening news, but first, here's some promos.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Tanya Stevens in Concert on Saturday, March 31st from 9 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. at the Tao Event Center in Portland. Tanya Stevens is an influential reggae artist who began releasing records in 1994. Opening the show will be Cat and Roots Revolution plus DJ Margot Hartenfeld. There will also be food and other refreshments. Again, that's Tanya Stevens in Concert on Saturday, March 31st from 9 p.m. to 2:30 a.m. at the Tao Event Center, 631 Northeast Grand Avenue in Portland. This is an 18 and over show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I said life is much too quick for your hurry, and there's too many problems, so tell me, oh, why worry?
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Peace Jam Northwest on Saturday, April 7th and Sunday, April 8th at the Erb Memorial Union on the University of Oregon campus in Eugene. Open to teens of age 14 to 18, the Peace Jam Conference will include several addresses by Dr. Shireen Abadi, the first woman ever to become a judge in Iran and the first Muslim woman to win the Peace Prize. There will also be service projects, workshops in leadership, civic engagement, peace building, and more. Again, that's the Peace Jam Northwest on Saturday, April 7th and Sunday, April 8th at the Erb Memorial Union on the University of Oregon campus in Eugene. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO. Guess what? It's time for the Friday evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, former Oregon Governor Kitzhaber agrees to pay a $20,000 fine.
The verdict on the mysterious crash that ended in the deaths of the Harts is still unsolved.
Russia's expelling more diplomats in response to what its ministry says is unfair treatment from Britain.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 30th, 2018. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Annette Newell. Oregon's former governor, John Kitzhaber, has agreed to pay up to $20,000 for committing 10 Oregon ethics violations during his governorship. According to the Statesman Journal, during a hearing before the Government Ethics Commission earlier today, Kitzhaber said, quote, "I erred and I assume full responsibility for it." Kitzhaber's referring to his fourth term of governor, where the private energy business dealings of his fiancée, Sylvia Hayes, became too blurred with her public role as his energy advisor and state's first lady. It was only after he became caught up in his office's missteps that Kitzhaber resigned, allowing current Governor Kate Brown to take her seat in 2015. The settlement comes after months of back and forth between Ethics Commission and Kitzhaber's team, which originally offered the state a small $1,000 in fines. After adding the total 10 ethics violations, such as breaking the state's conflict of interest law and accepting gifts over $50 as a public official, the commission doled out the $20,000 bill. The payout falls well below the maximum fine of $50,000. The Ethics Commission is still waiting to hear how Hayes will respond to 22 ethics violations filed against her in January. She will either have to agree to a $110,000 fine and hundreds of thousands of dollars in contracts she won while she was First Lady of Oregon, or contest the claim, which would put her case in a courtroom.
4 days after an entire Oregon family seems to have died when their SUV plunged over a cliff on the California coast, friends and investigators are attempting to untangle the knot of contradictory evidence leading up to the tragedy. The GMC Yukon was found on its roof in the Pacific Ocean in Mendocino County. Inside the SUV was Jennifer Jean Hart, the driver, and Sarah Margaret Hart, both 38 years old. Three of their adopted children, Marcus, 19, Abigail, 14, and Jeremiah, 13, were thrown out of the SUV. The other three children are still missing, and investigators say they may also have been thrown from the vehicle. One of the children missing is Devontae Hart, who in 2014 was shown in a photo that went viral. The picture featured an officer holding Devontae Hart in what appears to be a tender embrace as Devontae cries during a protest. The other missing children are Hannah, 16, and Sierra, 12. Questions around the case stem from the location and the family's last-minute decision to visit the coast on the same day child welfare workers knocked on their door in a remote area of northern Clark County. They had moved to Washington about 10 months before from West Lynn, where they had lived for 4 years. No one witnessed the crash. Investigators say hours or days could have passed before someone spotted the SUV. The GMC Yukon was at the bottom of a 100-foot cliff across a 75-foot dirt turnout on a straight section of Route 1 north of Westwood. There were no skid marks or indications of an accident. Investigators say to drive off the cliff, Jennifer Hart would have had to make a sharp 90-degree turn from the ward and transverse the entire turnout and continue driving up over a short berm that sits at the cliff top. California Highway Patrol officers Olegaria Marin said roads on the Northern California coast are dangerous but can't recall any crashes at the turnout in question within the last 6 years. He elaborated today that detectives have no reason to believe the crash was intentional and is still approaching the investigation as an accident.
The tension between Russia and the West over the poisoning of a former double agent in Britain heightened today as Russia ordered additional cuts to the number of British envoys in the country. Russia also summoned 23 foreign ambassadors to inform them that a noticeable number of their diplomats would be expelled, just a day after giving the order to expel 60 U.S. diplomats to leave and demanding Washington's consulate in St. Petersburg to immediately close. The large expulsion of diplomats on either side has reached a scale unseen, even in comparison to the peak of the Cold War. Moscow has firmly denied involvement in the March 4th nerve agent attack in the English city of Salisbury. The ministry upped its response today, saying it has ordered Britain to reduce the number of its diplomats in Moscow to the level Russia maintains in London. The exact number has not been made clear, but according to the state news agency, which quoted an unnamed source, that number is somewhere around 50 people. Escalating this crisis, the ministry said today that a plane belonging to Russian state airline Aeroflot was being searched by police in London with no explanation. A ministry spokeswoman told the AP that this is, quote, the latest provocation. Russia has accused Britain of failing to back up its accusations with evidence and refusing to share materials from the probe. The foreign ministry says it's ready to cooperate in the investigation. The countries informed today by Russia of diplomatic expulsions are Australia, Albania, Germany, Denmark, Ireland, Spain, Italy, Canada, Latvia, Lithuania, Macedonia, Moldova, the Netherlands, Norway, Poland, Romania, Ukraine, Finland, France, Croatia, the Czech Republic, Sweden, and Estonia.
As the Associated Press reports, two British militants who are believed to belong to an Islamic State group cell known for beheading hostages in Syria said today that their home country's revoking of their citizenship bars them from the possibility of a fair trial. One of the pair said the killings of captives was a mistake and could have been avoided entirely. Each of the men were with four British jihadis, making up the ISIS cell that was nicknamed the Beatles by surviving captives because of their English accents. The cell held more than 20 Western hostages in Syria and was known for its brutality, torturing its captives and beheading several American, British, and Japanese journalists, including aid workers and Syrian soldiers, between 2014 and 2015. The two men, El-Shafi El-Sheikh and Alexandra Amon Koti, were captured last January in eastern Syria by Kurdish-led U.S.-backed Syrian forces during the collapse of the Islamic State. The men remained tight-lipped about what their roles were, but attested to the allegations that they belonged to the before-named cells, the Beatle cell, and were directly involved in kidnappings and killings. When asked about the beheadings of American journalist James Foley and other victims, Cody said many in ISIS would have disagreed with the killings on the grounds that the prisoners would be more beneficial as political prisoners. The pair also blamed Western governments for failing to negotiate, pointing out that some hostages were released for ransoms. They detailed being told their credibility would go if they didn't go along with the killings under ISIS. El-Sheikh's family came to Britain from Sudan when he was a child, and he was a mechanic in West London. Koti, who is Ghanaian and Greek, converted to Islam in his 20s and hails from London's Paddington neighborhood. Koti and El-Sheikh continued to dismiss the atrocities of the group they were a part of, comparing its executions to death sentences in other countries. They claim that revoking of their British citizenship is illegal and is setting them up for an unfair trial. The capture has created a debate between the United States and Britain as to where and how to prosecute the pair of ISIS members.
Adidas leaders announced Thursday that they are expanding their headquarters in Portland after they've more than doubled their growth in the city during the last 3 years alone. They also announced a plan to build a new world-class collaboration center, in addition to a recently constructed maker lab at the center of its campus. Other renovations will be general upgrades to the facilities. Adidas says it hopes to make employees more comfortable. Adidas' workforce has grown from 800 to 1,700, with their quarterly earnings up 33% in North America alone.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and other city leaders passed their first batch in a list of upgrades for the city this week. They've whittled down a list of improvements to community centers, streets, and sidewalks. Wheeler has plans by 2040 with a $600 million price tag. It's a program he calls Build Portland. Portland City Council approved seven projects with a cost of $50 million Wednesday. They include $15 million for the Mount Scott Community Center, $4 million for the Lentz Town Center, $10.5 million to make sidewalks compliant with the Americans with Disability Act, $10 million for the Outer Stark Corridor, $3 million for North Lombard Street, and $3 million to replace a bridge across Northeast 42nd Avenue. KBOO's Annette Newell spoke with Wheeler about this plan this week.
You're asking for a big bond project and lots of improvements for the city of Portland. So tell me about these exciting plans and why you think they're necessary.
Well, the city of Portland has struggled, as have all large cities, to fund basic infrastructure, things like roads, community centers, and other civic infrastructure that needs to be maintained. Last year during the budget, we introduced what's called Build Portland, and it redirects funding that's spent inside urban renewal areas. And when those urban renewal areas expire, rather than just spending it on the project of the day, we're reserving that funding for road improvement, road reconstruction, and other civic infrastructure. The city council is going to approve the first $50 million of those projects. These are projects that the community has wanted for years, if not decades. Things like the Outer Stark reconstruction, the Mount Scott Community Center, and other civic infrastructure that's on the list. We have about seven major projects that we're teeing up.
When you're talking about that much of bonds, that's going to add to the city's debt. So how do you balance between making it worth it for the city to go into that kind of debt with the benefits?
Actually, what's happening is the urban renewal areas are expiring, And so the resources are going to be redirected towards these projects. Yes, we will issue bonds, but those bonds are actually serviced with the dollars that have been redirected from the urban renewal districts. So this is a net gain for the city in terms of being able to invest in infrastructure. We're not taking funding away from any other existing program. We're not raising anybody's taxes. What we're doing is being fiscally smart and reserving the funding for investments in the kind of infrastructure that cities like Portland have ignored for decades. This will represent $600 million in investments in things like roads over the next 20 years.
Is there one part of it that you, in particular, is your favorite or the one that you think is most necessary? I know it's a very ambitious plan.
The public has wanted the Lentz Town Center project for many, many years, and the Mount Scott Community Center and the Outer Stark redevelopment. All of these are projects that have been on the list year after year after year. And the public has said, hey, Portland City Council, get your act together and do these things. But we never had a clear strategic or financial plan to do it. Build Portland gives us that strategy. It gives us that plan, and it identifies and reserves specific resources to get these projects done. Other cities around the country are taking a good hard look at how we're doing this, because this is really a unique and responsible way to fund critical infrastructure.
Okay, thank you.
Centro de Apoyo Mutuo is a revolution sweeping Puerto Rico in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. In opposition to pressures from the U.S. government and the Puerto Rican ruling class to increase Puerto Rico's dependence on the U.S. for food and other resources while boosting the massive billion-dollar number the U.S. is claiming Puerto Rico owes under current imposed policy, the indigenous Tiano peoples of Puerto Rico have been pooling resources to set up medical houses and kitchens. Activists Oceana and Danielle Velez have been asked to visit the U.S. to hold talks about what they say is the Tiano, the First Nations way of organizing and forming solidarity in direct opposition to neoliberalism and colonialism. In just a handful of months, there are already 9 centers for De Apoyo Mutuo in Puerto Rico. Daniel Velez will be speaking April 3rd at 6:30 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. KBOO's Zelos Ellis Marchant spoke to him this morning while he was traveling from Oakland, California.
Are you hoping to start Centro de Apoyo Mutuos here in the United States, or are you just wanting to get the word out about what's happening in Puerto Rico and just share different concepts about that?
We're just here, you know, to let people from the U.S. know what we're doing there. You are, like, you know, in the United States, it's another context, and you have your own history and stuff. So, yeah, come over. That would be kind of pretentious for me to, or for us to, you know, be thinking of that. But I believe, like, the experience, it's very, very significant. It is very significant and can, you know, teach some lessons maybe, or, you know, like, people, activists from here and people that want to build more sustainable societies can, you know, grasp some things for their own struggles and processes. So, and of course, we also are, like, gaining a lot of perspective and you know, a lot of what things can we change because of that interactions with activists and people that are doing work here in the United States. So yeah, that enriched us a lot, you know, like these talks and having this opportunity to talk with this variety of people doing so many works here. So yeah, for us basically it's like to spread out the word of what we're doing there, like these works usually are not commented in the media too much. But even though they have the ruling class have a a plan for Puerto Rico to basically transport this or bring this rich crypto guys to Puerto Rico to live and to kick out basically a lot of the working class people from the United States, from the island, making the situation very tough for us to live there. That there is a lot of people resisting and building spaces for a new Puerto Rico, but I am calling it like a new the rebuilding of Borinquen, because Puerto Rico is the name that the first colonial ruling the Spaniards gave us. Mm-hmm. So, like, basically all the history of Puerto Rico is one of repression and colonialism. So before that, the native Indians, the Arawaks or Taino Indians, they called the island Borinquen. Mm-hmm. So we're, like, trying to rebuild Borinquen, not Puerto Rico. Like, Puerto Rico, we just want to, you know, bury Puerto Rico and build a new, rebuild Borinquen, you know, this sustainable society that used to be there. We're trying to get it back, you know, but in our context. So yeah, basically that's the nature of the talk.
Cuando en la vida se sufre una herida, porque se pierde sangre querida.
That was Celos Marchant talking with Daniel Velez from the Centro de Pollo Mucho, who will be holding a talk at the Social Justice Action Center on April 3rd at 6:30 to discuss what the Taino people are doing to create solidarity within their nation and open more health, medical, and food centers in Puerto Rico. The full interview will be broadcast in Monday's Cesar Chavez Day edition of the KBOO Evening News.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Bread and Roses with your host, Della Ray. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, cloudy, low 43, 10% chance of rain. Saturday looks a little better. We'll have some clouds in the morning, then sun in the afternoon, a high of 64. On this date in history, John Hinckley Jr. shot President Ronald Reagan on March 30th, 1981, outside a Washington, D.C. hotel. A bullet hit his lung, just missing his heart. Reagan's surgery lasted 2 hours, and he was in good condition afterward. The quote of the day is from former White House Press Secretary James Brady, who was also shot and almost killed in that assassination attempt. He became an ardent supporter of gun control and said, quote, "It is not a loss of freedom, it is a measure to protect it."
And now it's time for today's report from the National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation is suing the federal government and Arizona law enforcement agencies for wrongful death for the 2016 police shooting of L'Oreal Sinogeny. Courthouse News reports the Navajo Nation filed suit this week in U.S. District Court in Arizona. The tribe claims the government violated Sinogeny's rights when a Winslow police officer shot and killed her as she brandished a pair of scissors. After the Maricopa County Attorney's Office cleared the officer, the Navajo Nation asked the Justice Department to investigate. In October 2017, the DOJ said it couldn't refute the officer's claim that he shot the woman in self-defense. The lawsuit says Sinogeny had a history of mental health-related issues and faults the Winslow Police Department for inadequate training. Maine's Penobscot Nation is coming out against that state's attorney general for favoring a review of treaty fishing rights in a case on the other side of the country. It's the latest in a long-running battle between the tribe and the state over treaty issues. Isaac Kestenbaum reports.
Maine Attorney General Janet Mills is drawing criticism from the Penobscot Nation for getting involved in another state's tribal fishing rights case. Along with 10 other states, Mills filed a friend of the court brief in what's known as the Culvert case in Washington State. Penobscot Chief Kirk Francis calls it a clear attack on tribal fishing rights.
When we see her reaching out all the way across the country to try to solidify her position, it's really concerning to us.
Mills is siding with Washington State's fight against the 2013 federal court order to replace hundreds of road culverts blocking salmon migration. That order stemmed from a lawsuit brought by more than 20 tribes with treaty fishing rights, and it's now going to the Supreme Court. For Chief Francis, that original court order is about the difference between having the right to fish and the ability to actually catch healthy fish.
What it says is you don't only have a right to fish, you have a right to a quality of life in that fishery and access to those fish as well.
The Penobscot Nation is in a long battle with the state of Maine over the Penobscot River. A few years ago, the EPA imposed its own federal water quality standards in the river after it found that the state standards were too low to protect fish-eating tribes. Maine disagrees and is appealing this decision. Both sides see Washington's culvert case as potentially setting a precedent. For Attorney General Mills, it's about federal overreach. In a statement, Mills said she deeply respects the fishing rights of Maine's tribes, but that the federal government can't be trusted to develop or enforce environmental protections. She said her office is, quote, committed to making sure Maine's jurisdiction is protected and kept intact. Oral arguments will begin in the Supreme Court on April 18th. For National Native News, I'm Isaac Kestenbaum.
The Federal Communications Commission is selecting new members for its Native Nations Broadband Task Force. As Sol Traverso reports, it's an advisory board that recommends ways to improve access on tribal lands.
A 2015 FCC Broadband Progress Report found the digital divide continues to be great in Indian Country, with 85% of tribal land residents lacking broadband access. Loris Taylor, president and CEO of Native Public Media, says there are a number of contributing factors for the absence of high-speed internet in Native communities, and adds tribal consultation is needed when it comes to plans and policies.
Internet lags behind on reservations due primarily to the cost of internet and the limited resources for the infrastructure that's needed to make internet available in homes.
Matthew Duchesne is the FCC Chief of Native Affairs and Policy. He says board members will bring tribal concerns to the agency.
The purpose is to collect input from tribal representatives on matters of tribal interest that are before or being considered by the Federal Communications Commission.
The task force was created in 2010 and consists of 20 tribal members from around the country and 11 FCC staff members. This will be its third renewal. For National Native News, I'm Sol Traverso.
And I'm Hannah Colton.
Next, we hear from reporter Tom Flynn, who has been working on a new 20-part series that begins airing at 11 a.m. on Monday, April 3rd. It's called Retired or Rewired? The Challenge of Aging in a City That Worships Youth. Is Portland a great city to grow old in? In this brief excerpt from the series, Flynn introduces us to the Village Movement. It's an effort to help older folks stay in their homes. In just 10 years, the Village Movement has grown nationwide, and there are now 8 villages in Portland. Find out what this movement represents and the impact it's having on our city.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. We had a technical difficulty. We'll be getting you the story from Tom Flynn next week. In the wake of the testimony of Canadian whistleblower Christopher Wiley, we can no longer pretend that our social network information is safe. KBOO's Ray Bodwell has some thoughts.
Here's our series on aging in Portland. Retired or rewired? What it's like getting old in a youth-centered city. Are you up for that challenge? We'll bring you lots of views, but you'll have to answer this question for yourself. Is Portland a good place in which to grow old? This is a brief portion of one of the episodes from the upcoming series. Here we're speaking with Dr. Allison Lindauer of the Layton Institute, a unit in OHSU that works with Alzheimer's patients. She tells us what Alzheimer's is and how her team works to diagnose the disease and help families navigate the treatment process. Dr. Lindauer, the family comes in, potential patient. How do you know that they have Alzheimer's? How do you diagnose it?
We work with a team, so the neurologist will typically do a careful assessment to make sure that there aren't other things that are causing a memory problem. So, for example, maybe the person drinks too much alcohol and that's affecting their function. We'll have a neuropsychologist do an assessment, and we will also do memory testing while they're in the clinic. In our practice, typically what we'll do is we'll have case conference where we talk about each case to make sure that we got the diagnosis right. As you know, at this point in time, there is no specific test that we can do, no blood test, no brain scan that we can do that says, absolutely, this is Alzheimer's. We're getting closer. Our scans are getting better. But a lot of the diagnostic process is making sure that we're not missing something else and putting the pieces of the puzzle together as a team.
Are you interested in family history when you diagnose? I mean, is this hereditary?
There are some hereditary components, but what I tell families is if your parents have dementia, there is a slight chance that you will, but don't lose sleep over it because it's not a direct correlation. If your mom had Alzheimer's, it doesn't mean you will. There are some very rare cases of hereditary dementia, hereditary Alzheimer's in young people that is hereditary, that is genetic, but most people, it's not genetic.
So you diagnose it. I guess your team kind of gets together and looks at all aspects of the symptoms.
Yeah, we have a really special team at the Layton Center. We have our neurologist, myself, a nurse practitioner. We have a neuropsychologist, and we have a social worker. And all of us try to help the families navigate this difficult course. We do things like help them learn how to use medications to their advantage, stop medications that may be harmful, talk about social support so we can protect caregivers from strain and burden, and help people navigate when they get close to the end of life and how to make those good decisions to have a peaceful death.
So these people come in, and one of them has Alzheimer's, and you talk through these issues. What do they do? What's your treatment? What are you going to tell them recommend?
So the last drug that was developed for Alzheimer's disease was in 2003. And those are the class of drugs we typically use are acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. They aren't wonderful drugs. They don't cure Alzheimer's. They don't even really improve memory. The drugs are designed to slow progression so that people are more functional at the end of life. So we'll talk to families about those things, but we'll also talk to them about the things that they can change. For example, are they taking medications that may be making their thinking cloudy, like many sleep medications can do that?
Is there a promising...